Christian Rob McGregor welcome you to a place where all kinds of phenomena flourish. Voices whisper, ancient secrets, signs and symbols are abundant. UFOs, ETs, ghosts, and even the dead move about freely. Here we meet authors, researchers, and investigators of the mysterious, the strange, and of the inexplicable anomalies that surround us. Step out of the everyday world and take a journey into the mystical underground.
Welcome to the Mystical Underground. Thank you for joining us. This is Trish McGregor and
Rob McGregor
and our producer and tech magician, John Posey. You can go to themysticalunderground.com where we make regular blog posts and where you can find out about our books. Among them are Phenomena, Harnessing Your Psychic Abilities, The Secret of Spirit Communication, Sensing the Future, and Aliens in the Backyard. Our latest book is called Mind-Blowing Synchronicities, the latest science stories and research. Trish's most recent novel, White is White Crows, and Rob's is called Tulpas. If you're watching us on YouTube, we would appreciate if you would take a second to click the like, subscribe, and notification buttons so you never miss an episode. If you prefer to listen to the show, it's available wherever you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe there.
Okay, our guest today is P.D. Newman. P.D. has been immersed in the study and practice of shamanism, theurgy, alchemy, hermetism, and for more than two decades. The author of Theurgy, Theory and Practice, Angels in Vermilion, and Alchemically Stone. I sound like I'm stoned. The Psychedelic Secret of Freemasonry. His latest book, the one we're going to be talking about, is called Tripping the Trail of Ghosts, Psychedelics and the Afterlife Journey in the Native American Mound Culture. P.D. lives in Tupelo, Mississippi, which is near several middle woodland mound sites. Welcome, P.D.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Finally.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm glad you're able to make it and that your house is in better shape after that storm. So your book is about, I'm familiar with the mound culture, but your book is about a Native American culture that the term I had never heard of, the Mississippians, which is kind of interesting because I grew up right next to the Mississippi River, but in Minnesota, southern Minnesota. But can you tell us about who the Mississippians were?
Sure. They were a number of tribes that make up the Mississippians, but the Mississippians came after the Hopewell and Adena cultures. And they first emerged around 1000 AD, although there's some evidence that they might have been around a few centuries earlier. And just like the name says, they occupied the areas in and around the Mississippi River and the Mississippi Valley.
Why did they build mounds?
Well, there are a number of reasons. And in the case of the Mississippians, they also inherited mounds that were built by the preceding Hopewell and Adena cultures. For example, the Ohio mounds with this great serpent mound.
Right.
Those are Hopewell mounds.
Okay.
So the Mississippians, in many cases, inherited these, maintained them, oftentimes embellished them. But the purposes that they serve are also many. Oftentimes we'll see just one mound, and then as often we'll see clusters of mounds. Now, when the mounds are clustered, it's often true that the mound site itself serves as a sort of calendar, so that if you're standing on one mound and you look in the direction of a neighboring mound, if the sun rise, sunset, moonrise or moonset occur in alignment with it, that's an indication of the time of year, the solstices or the equinoxes. They were preoccupied with the greater lunar cycle, which is a 18.6 year cycle. So basically, where these luminaries rose, with which mound they aligned, indicated to them it was time to harvest, or it's time to till, or it's time to plant, things like that. And they also served as, and this is really what I focus on in the book, as a sort of training ground for what is known as the path of souls. It's an afterlife model, a journey that the soul goes on. And just like we might have rites of passage, indigenous rites of passage for, say, passing a boy into manhood, or in more contemporary terms, a marriage is a rite of passage. It's the movement from one station of life or station of being to another station. And so the afterlife journey is one such rite of passage. Death is a rite of passage. And they would use, in certain cases, they would use the mound site in its entirety as a virtual training ground for the afterlife terrain. The obstacles they expected to encounter, the trials they were expected to go through.
So now, have you gone and seen these mounds? I mean,
many. I was just at one yesterday. My youngest son and I, we traveled down south to Rodney, which is a ghost town in Mississippi. And near Rodney is what's known as the Mangum Mound, and it is enormous. And this mound is pre-Mississippian, and it's interesting and different from some of the other mounds in that there was known human sacrifice practiced there. And human sacrifice was practiced at a number of different sites, but this is one that is specifically known for that.
For what reason were these sacrifices?
In this case, when a chief passed, all of the chiefs, the noblemen, we might call them, would also go with him into the afterlife. So something similar that's seen in some cases in Egypt, in India, where the wife would practice immolation following the death of her husband and go with him. In some cases,
horses sometimes too, even.
Yeah. And in some cases, it might have been against their will. But in many cases, it wasn't. Human sacrifice and a number of cultures. I know this is true in South America and some cases in Central America, where they willingly are sacrificed because it's seen as sort of a blessing in that they're kind of put directly into the presence of the deity or the spirit.
And they're usually subjected to drugs before that, too.
That's right. In South America, that's certainly true. It was likely true here. But there was evidence that they were given ayahuasca in South America. They were given coca leaves to chew. So yes, and this was likely, you know, there's disagreement on why. The negative explanations are that it was to drug them up so that they'd be easier to sacrifice. Mm-hmm. But I think a much more generous explanation and one that is in line with the way these substances were used in these cultures was to put them in a proper state of consciousness to be able to pass directly into the domain that they are aiming for, to put them into a trance state so that when they pass, they've already got one foot in there, if that makes sense.
Yeah. But they wouldn't use these on horses.
Say again? Not.
They wouldn't use psychedelics on horses.
No, likely not.
Yeah. That'd be pretty weird.
Right, yeah. So did they have a belief that they would come back to another life? Was that...
Some cultures did.
Uh-huh.
But there were, you know, you got to keep in mind that even though we're grouping them under the Mississippian umbrella, from tribe to tribe, they can have vastly different ideas about the soul, whether it reincarnates, whether it is able to pass into a happy afterlife. In some cases, the belief was total oblivion, that there was nothing. So it's just as variable as today we might encounter on the street any number of different ideas and pictures of what someone might think happens in the afterlife. And it's just as complex with the variants in these tribes.
Yeah.
So you think you had a past life in one of these? I mean, because your interest is deep.
You know, I've had experiences that led me to think about the soul in those terms. But to be totally honest, you know, I don't know. I'm at a place in my life where I'm kind of open to my soul showing me what it wants me to know. But that being said, even if reincarnation is not real, I still think it's a valuable belief.
Mm-hmm.
You think, to put it one way, let's say that you have found an individual that you believe they might have been a past life of yours. Well, whether or not that's true, it automatically kind of highlights your own value system, even those that you might be unconscious about, because in a way you're saying, I kind of want some of what they have.
Uh-huh.
Or I think I have some of what they have, but in either case, it helps in the process of self-discovery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's led you into this journey into the indigenous Mississippians and their entheogenetic plants? That's their proper name? Yeah, genetic plants.
I've always been fascinated by indigenous cultures and being in the South where I grew up, seeing these burial mounds, Native American mounds around me. It's always piqued my interest.
Uh-huh.
And I'm very attracted to earth-based philosophies, religions, magics, things like that. Mm-hmm. And now what got me interested in the psychedelics was the fact that I'm interested in psychedelics anyway. They've been a major part of my life since I was around 11 years old. Was the first time I had a psychedelic experience. And I was raised Southern Baptist, and nothing against Southern Baptists or anybody who worships in that way. But for me and my experience with the church I was brought up in, it never really appealed to me. And it wasn't until I had my very first psychedelic experience that I realized what worship meant, what it meant to be in a state of worship and divine awe. So that immediately kind of pulled me in an entirely different direction.
Did you have a guide on this first trip?
Not really. No, I had a guide that taught me how to identify certain species. For instance, psychedelic mushrooms, the cubensis that grow here, that taught me what time of the year they grow, the markers that separate them from lookalikes. So I had a guide in that sense, but once I got my feet wet, I was pretty much on my own. It was sink or swim, you know?
So it's fascinating that the psychedelic drugs, over history, cultures and, great distances, have been around for a long time. And it's, so it seems to be something of our nature that's, and it happens separately. It
not
seems.
In everybody's nature, Rob. I could never see my parents taking hallucinogenics.
I'm talking.
No, I know.
Yeah. So, do you think these were discovered? I guess my question is: do you think these were discovered separately in different regions of the world, or were they communicated that these existed, or how is this spread? I mean, it's really about the spirit contact, isn't it?
I think both. I really do think both. You're right, that it is something that's been with man since, I believe, since our inception, since we became Homo sapiens. You know, the McKenna brothers talk about, you know, the vast plains of Africa and the natural drive to find food. And nothing can be more obvious than a mushroom growing at your feet. And so the introduction to it that way would have been a natural process. But when we think about something that's a bit more complex, like ayahuasca, that requires two plants to function in the way that we think about ayahuasca as a powerful visionary tool, you know, that you think about all of the hundreds of thousands of plants that grow in the rainforest, and they were able to hone in on the two that have to be combined to get this effect. Now, when you ask the natives themselves, how did you learn about this? They make no qualms about it. They say that the spirits told us, that the spirits in these plants told us how to do it. And I'm perfectly fine with that way of thinking. I do believe there is a very intelligent, ancient spirit behind a number of these different entheogenic plants.
It's so interesting you say this
at all.
Rob and I used to lead tours up the Amazon. And on the first tour, our guide was he was a great guy. And he said, "Do you all want to do ayahuasca?" I said, "Sure. What do we need to do?" And he said, "Well, it's a 3-day trek into the jungle." And we said, "I don't know about that. I mean, we've got all these people on board this boat."
Yeah, we were leading the tour. We couldn't couldn't really lead them away. So,
I asked him, "How do you know about this stuff?" And he said, "The spirits talked to me."
Yeah,
and he was Amazonian. He grew up there,
and I absolutely believe it.
Yeah,
and real quick, if I can add this, and since you know, Tupelo, I grew up in Muscle Shoals, Alabama.
Okay.
And
another good music town.
And so the Indian mound there, and you know, part of the legend is that the singing river that spoke to the natives. Any insight on that? As far as the Tennessee River being the singing river?
Not in connection with psychedelics, but as a spirit of the river, absolutely. I completely ascribe to that notion, and they're often called spiritus loci or local genius, mm-hmm. and these are spirits that literally inhabit a specific land, a specific river. They can inhabit certain trees, and I'm a panpsychist. I believe that if something exists, there is a spirit attached to it. It's conscious to the degree that it's capable of being conscious. Mm-hmm. It might not have a mind in the way that we think of it, but I think mind is universal, wow. and is probably the ultimate substance behind any material thing. So in that regard, I do think there are spirits present in what we might consider inanimate objects. And when it comes to things like rivers, even more so. There's a great story about the Greek philosopher Pythagoras. And I'm really, you'll learn, really immersed in ancient Greek culture and philosophy and magic. But Pythagoras had prayed to the spirit of this river for days and days and days, until finally she emerged in a human form and stood there before him and spoke to him. And these kinds of stories are easily dismissed as, you know, myths or allegories or just plain made up stories. But I've had experiences very similar to that, even in our day and age. Huh. So I don't doubt it in the least.
Yeah,
I believe that Jung also believed in spirits of things like rivers.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And he, you know, he was a doctor. He's a scientist.
Right.
And so naturally, he had to go about discussing mm-hmm. these things in a way that was acceptable to the medical right. establishment. So he talked about it in terms of projection.
Right.
Now that you projected a portion, an archetype, some kind of unconscious content
uh-huh.
is mobilized and is projected into the thing in your environment that is the most fit receptacle right. for whatever that content is. You know, but you read between the lines, and it's
so he was a mystic.
That he,
you know, he may have been a psychiatrist, but he was also a mystic.
That's right. He was a mystic
really
through
was.
And through.
Yeah.
You wrote another book, Alchemically Stoned: The Psychedelic Secrets of Freemasonry. I had not know about any connection between psychedelics and Freemasonry. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. So, like I said, I had been experimenting with psychedelics from a very young age, and that it was mostly with things like LSD and psilocybin and cannabis. But I knew about N,N-DMT, dimethyltryptamine, and it was kind of, to me, it was like the holy grail of hallucinogens. But I had never encountered it. I didn't know how to get my hands on any. So it kind of assumed this kind of mythical quality in my life. And I ran across a book that talked about organic sources that had DMT in them and gave methods for extracting it from the plant. And so I acquired some of this plant matter, which at the time was Mimosa hostilis, also known as Acacia tenuiflora, and did the extraction process and arrived at a viable smokable material that gave me very profound experiences. So profound that I had no vocabulary for it. I had no frame of reference for it. Mm. And the closest thing to what I was experiencing was in Eastern texts like the Tao Te Ching and the Vedas, the Upanishads. But of course, I'm in Tupelo. There are no ashrams here. There are no Indians, gurus, yogis I can go talk to. But I had read in books on Western magic, different authors talking about how masonry was in possession of many of these same mysteries as some of these Eastern cultures. And masonry is very visible in the South. It's something that, you know, if your father's one, chances are you're going to be one. And even if you're not, 9 times out of 10, your grandfather was. So I looked into masonry. I found a lodge, found two masons that would sign my petition. Never thought I'd get in, but I got accepted. And I went through the first degree and was very impressed with what I was encountering. Went through the second degree, even more profound material is laid at your feet. But then I get to the third degree, and the third degree is a mythodrama, a ritual that's based on a mythological story, a sequence that, unbeknownst to you, you're going to play the main character in it. And it's a death and a resurrection kind of a ritual. Well, central to this ceremony and to this myth is acacia. There's an acacia, and it's placed on the grave of this individual, of you, but the main character in this myth. And you got to remember, the whole reason I got involved in masonry was because of these experiences I was having with DMT. And I had extracted that DMT from Acacia tenua flora. So I thought to myself, wow, what are the chances that I'm going to see this same plant here in this ritual? And the ritual itself is about death and resurrection, which is some of the experiences I was having, entering the realm of the dead. You know,
that's a really good synchronicity.
That's what I was going to say.
I pushed it down, you know, because I thought, no, this is confirmation bias. You need to meet the ritual and its symbols on its own terms. So I put that out of my mind and continued with my studies. And I began reading every single version of the Master Mason ritual I can find, because they vary slightly from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And come 2011, my wife is enrolled at Ole Miss. She's pregnant with our third son, Bacchus. And I'm reading Count Cagliostro, who himself was a mystic and an alchemist. I'm reading his version, which is known as the Egyptian Rite of Freemasonry. And in it, the candidate, the one being initiated, walks up to the master's altar, and there is a goblet, a cup, and in this cup is a red liqueur, an elixir, and he's told to drink it. And while he's drinking it, the worshipful master, who the man in charge in the lodge, he says, I want you to drink this because it's going to raise your spirit so that you may understand what I'm about to say. Now, this is a man writing in the 18th century, so you have to consider the language he had access to and the turns of phrase. But I think that's about as close as you could get to saying, this is going to expand your consciousness and alter the way you perceive what's about to happen. And while he's drinking it, he says, what you're drinking is made from the prima materia, the first matter of alchemy. And he says, this is nothing other than the acacia, which was given to you in the degree of Master Mason. So he's telling him, you're drinking something that's been taken out of acacia, and it's going to alter your consciousness. And sure enough, the next sequence in the ritual, he has a vision of angels coming to him. So it causes a visionary effect. So I thought, holy cow, you know, that this might be for real. The acacia might be here because of its visionary potential. And so the next question was, well, how did it get into masonry? And I find that in the earliest version of the Mason ritual, it wasn't there. There's no mention of it. And it didn't get put in until a man who was the research assistant for Sir Isaac Newton in the Royal Society became the Grand Master of the Premier Grand Lodge in London. And he rewrote the ritual and put the acacia in there. And I could keep talking as to why he put it in there, but long story short is the Royal Society at one time was on this wild goose chase to try and find a psychoactive plant that would fit the bill for an alchemical red powder that they were researching and trying to identify. And based on the writings of an alchemist named Samuel Hartlib, whose papers they had in the Royal Society, in their archives, they came to settle on the acacia. So because of its visionary potential and its role in alchemy, it got inserted into masonry, where today it's still there, only in the form of a symbol. But at one time, they were actually drinking.
So now it's just symbolic. That's interesting.
Now it's just symbolic, and but the clues are still there that for anyone who looks at that with the right eyes and puts enough elbow grease into it, they'll arrive at the same conclusions I did. So it's a symbol, but it's also an invitation.
Right.
What kind of plant is the acacia?
Acacia is it's a mimosa. Basically, you've seen mimosa trees.
Okay. It's like the acacia tree, Rob.
That's exactly acacia.
Yeah, it's the acacia tree. We got them all over our dog park.
Right. I bet. It's what Osiris was encased in the Egyptian myth, which is to say the god is in the tree.
Yeah.
Right.
Are you familiar with the angel trumpet plant?
Very.
Yeah.
Yeah. So our daughter's backyard is full of those. And, she was taking care of some animals for a while, dog sitting, and she was very concerned that the dogs would get into the angel trumpets. But it seems like, you know, if you like even get near them and, you know, take a nap underneath one, you might start having a psychedelic experience.
There are lots of stories about that. And I can tell you from personal experience, and I was told to do this by a Native American because they were using Datura. Mm-hmm. And Datura is in the same nightshade family, has the same scopolamine alkaloids. And he said that, yes, it was consumed. It was also used externally as an oil, which immediately made me think of the flying ointments of the early witches and how they would mix mandrake, which is in the same family with the same alkaloids, in with certain oils and smear them on their bodies so that they could fly to the Sabbath. But he said, yes, it was used in these ways. But he said the most common way is the scent. He said the scent of the blooming flower itself is psychoactive. And he said, we use it to affect our dreams. And he told me to take some, place them next to my pillow, and report back to him on what dreams I had and how vivid they were. And he was absolutely correct. Just the smell of it is enough to induce some psychoactivity.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I've been tempted to make like a tea from those flowers, but I don't know, you know, how to do it to do it safely, because I think you can OD on it too.
It's very dangerous.
Yeah,
you need to if you're gonna do it, it's one of those things that you really do need a guide that knows how much is safe to use, but I've been experimenting with it for a long time. I've used it in fumigations. I've rolled it up with tobacco. Yeah. I've eaten small amounts. Huh. I've added small amounts to teas. But the safest way to use it, and a method that is, even though it's safe, is still effective, is to make an ointment out of it with beeswax and oil. Huh. And boil heat the flowers up in an oil, whatever your preferred oil is, coconut oil. And then just like with any salve, add some beeswax pellets to it until it gets to a consistency that you can just kind of smear it on. And start by the way I started, rubbing it on my wrists. Mm-hmm. And see how that played out. The next time I'd use it, I'd put it on my wrists and the back of my neck. Huh. And then I'd do wrists, back of my neck, and my feet. You know, all of the places on your body, your belly button.
Right.
You know, that can safely absorb and get it right into your bloodstream. That's what I'd recommend if you are interested in pursuing a relationship with the spirit behind that plant.
We'll call you PD.
Yeah,
I don't want to be responsible for Rob's death.
I'm always here, and to be honest, I relish the opportunity to just get to nerd out on this stuff.
Right, yeah.
What about the acacia blooms? What can you do with those?
It depends on the species. Now, some species, the blooms themselves are active, but in most species, the concentrations of the NNDMT is in the root bark. So the outer bark stripped off the roots. And you'll notice it's a brilliant vermilion crimson color, which is why my second book is called Angels in Vermilion. Uh-huh. Because it was used as a pigment to make a vermilion dye. For fabrics.
I wonder, I mean, sometimes the acacia trees at the dog park have iguanas that are just like frozen in the tree. I just wonder if they've been eating the bark, you know, if they're like totally stoned or something.
It's possible. There's a great book by an Italian ethnobotanist named Giorgio Samarini, and it's called Animals and Psychedelics. Huh. And he basically goes through all of the known relationships between animals, insects, and the psychedelic plants that they form a relationship with.
Wow.
But even with ayahuasca, with the Banisteriopsis copy vine, which is the ayahuasca proper, it doesn't have DMT in it. That's in the Sacotria viridis leaves, but the MAOI is in the vine. And that's what ayahuasca, that's what it means, vine of the soul or rope of the dead, because it's like a rope. Jaguars are frequently observed eating the vine and very obviously having an effect, having an experience. And Terrence McKenna, there's a funny part in his book True Hallucinations.
I love that
book. He talks about he and his brother went to La Charrera in search of ukuhe, a DMT paste that was active without the necessity of an MAOI. But and while he's there, their journey gets sidetracked by their discovery of psilocybe cubensis mushrooms. He talks about standing there looking over the field and seeing all these mushrooms, and there are wild dogs just running through there, biting the caps off of all the mushrooms and eating them, and then going their merry way.
Getting stoned out of their minds.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Many years ago, I was in Ecuador, and I was staying at this small little village. And in the room I was staying, there was all these paintings and of mushrooms on the walls that the locals are not necessarily the locals. I think the tourists actually were making. And so on this one particular day, this guy from Hawaii and I decided we would climb this mountain that was nearby. Well, we never got out of the field where the mushrooms were. We sampled a couple, and we ended up taking off our clothes and just laying there, melting into the earth. You know, I remember it was on Easter too, and you know, and this guy from Hawaii, he was traveling in Ecuador with a surfboard, which is really strange. And we're in the mountains, you know, which didn't seem to make much sense. But anyhow, he stands there naked with his arms out, you know, on Easter, and says, "It doesn't hurt. It doesn't hurt."
That sounds like Julian Cope. You familiar with Julian Cope?
No, I think so.
He's a musician, sang for the Teardrop Explodes, but developed a very intense relationship with LSD and ended up becoming something of a hermit. These days he's a mystic, very into druids and but there's a song on, he's got an album from 1992 called Jehovah Kill, and there's a song where he's talking about on Easter standing with his arms outstretched in the form of a cross. and he says something like, "I'm not afraid of the cross anymore," or something.
That's very similar.
Very.
That's funny.
Let's talk about another plant that we're all very familiar with, and that's the tobacco plant, and how with native cultures that it was actually a sacred tool. I don't think people think about tobacco as being a sacred tool.
You're exactly right. So with tobacco, I was asthmatic growing up, and I still have issues with my lungs. So I've never been a smoker, and I've never been attracted to chewing tobacco or dip, snuff. I've never had done it until I got into researching this last book.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept encountering all of these references to tobacco as being this a potent tool for communicating with the dead and for entering the realm of the dead. And I thought, you know, if that were true, people would be doing it every day. Everybody's smoking. How are they not doing this? And it turns out that commercial tobacco is made from Nicotiana tobaccum. What they're using is Nicotiana rustica, which can be anywhere between 3 and 9 times as potent, and it also contains monoamine oxidase inhibitor, just like in ayahuasca.
Hmm.
Now,
where do you get that from?
Do what?
Where do you get that from?
I can send you some if you want.
Your Marlboros, Rob. Your Marlboros.
You won't find it in the stores, but when I started this research, I got some seeds and I planted it and harvested it and learned how to cure it. Because you know, I'm writing this book on the Native American use of potent plant allies, and I don't have any clue about tobacco. So I thought, you know, if I'm going to do it justice and treat it faithfully, I at least need to develop a relationship with it. And so I started with a pipe. I got myself a nice Peterson pipe, and I loaded it with the rustica. I might have gotten a third of the way through this thing before I was covered in sweat.
Jeez.
And felt like I was sitting on the wall, like all of my sense of orientation was warped, and I passed out. I didn't know I had passed out, but I passed out and instantly was having visions of lightning bolts and bloody horses covered in blood, like they had been in battle, running past. You know, and before I knew it, I snap out of it, and I thought, well, of course that they're praising this for its visionary capacity, And when I started digging deeper, the lady who wrote the foreword for my book, Chris Van Poole, such a lovely, brilliant woman, one of my heroes, she has written extensively on the native use of tobacco and what they do with it. Now, at high enough doses, it wipes out the color sensors in the eyes. So everything takes on this kind of dingy gray, yellowish tone that literally makes you look, everybody look like they're a ghost, right? Uh-huh. So visually, that already begins to encourage the perception of the world as a realm of the dead. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
But if they smoke enough and keep going, and when I say enough, you remember I got a third of the way through a regular pipe.
Jeez.
They will roll cigars that are 3 feet long.
Oh,
God.
Of this stuff. And smoke it down to a roach. Now, if they smoke enough of it, it effectively kills them. Their breathing, their heart rate, everything is so low it's undetectable.
Jeez.
And they appear dead. Oh. And that's quite literally how they're into the afterlife and dealing with spirits.
Wow.
They're out of body, right?
They can only be there so long or it becomes dangerous. They can actually die.
Yeah.
Guess how they get brought out of it? Another shaman has to come blow more tobacco into him. And that jump starts everything. And they wake up with a start and they come back with the boons of wisdom and healing that they've brought back from the other side in the form of their experience, which they communicate to the other shamans and to the elders. And that gets passed all the way through the tribe. In stories, kind of like telephone game,
right?
It gets more and more appropriate for the younger. The tale goes for the younger persons, but these become living myths for them, right. Often involving their ancestors, because in indigenous cultures, ancestor worship is a very prevalent thing. Your ancestors are just as, if not more important than spirits. I'm reluctant to say gods because our Western concept of God is quite different than these beings they're interacting with, even though they would qualify as a deity. But
imagine it's
potent medicine.
Yeah, imagine the warnings that would be put on if the local companies, tobacco companies were making this stuff, you know. Yeah. it'll be the whole pack would be covered with warnings.
Yeah.
You're going to be a ghost.
You may be visited by your great grandfather.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Wow. That's
well, you certainly have an interesting life being doing all this research. I mean, it's
just
fascinating.
Follow my nose.
Yeah. That's great.
How does it work into your music? You're a musician as well.
I see music as a form of worship. You know, I don't make music for anyone specifically, any group of people. I simply make it as best as I can. And in that's my prayer. That's my act of worship. And, and I do incorporate a lot of ritualistic elements. And like I said earlier, I'm very infatuated with ancient Greek models. And for them, there are seven planets, which are the seven planets visible to the ancients, including the sun and the moon. Well, those seven planets also correspond to the seven tones and music. And these are seen to have correspondences. They in turn correspond to the seven colors and in the spectrum. So I'll construct music in order to capture something of a planetary essence. And this is true of the modes also. In Greek music theory, there are seven modes that can be played in addition to those seven keys. So you have ways of combining planets, you know. So let's say I want to make something a song that represents me and my wife as being married. You know, I might choose the key that corresponds to Leo, the sun, because Leo is in the ascendant in my natal chart. For hers, I'll choose the planet from her ascendant and play in that mode. So I'm the key, she's the mode. And then I will, you know, let my inspiration go where it goes. And I call on the muses, you know, I call on the specific deities or spirits that already embody something of the essence in which I'm trying to participate via the construction of this music. So my approach to music is very much sacred. Now, that being said, as an owner of a production company, I get approached by, you know, any musicians from any genre that have something very different in mind. So I'll have to limit my mojo, you know, when I'm working on something specifically for somebody else, but usually I'm able to sneak something in there.
What's your sun sign?
I'm an Aries.
With a Leo rising.
Leo rising, that's right.
Double fire. That's interesting. Yep. What about your wife?
She is a sun sign. She's a Libra, and in her ascendant, I believe is Cancer, but don't let me lie to you.
No. Interesting. What's your moon, do you know?
Libra. So my moon is
perfect.
Yeah. Yep.
Jung said that's the perfect relationship.
It really is. We are definitely partners in crime.
That's great.
PD, what happened to the Mississippians? Why don't
we got a real off base there? That was great.
Well, it's just like with other cultures that seem to have just disappeared.
Yeah,
you know, a big part of it was the colonization. You know, their entire way of life was basically taken away when the colonists came over.
Right.
A good example is raiding, war. You know, we think about war as something terrible, and it really is. And the way we do war, modern Western cultures, it's terrifying what we're capable of. But for them, the name of the game and how you received honor was through war and through your ability to successfully raid other tribes. And that being said, they also expected to be raided. And in this, it wasn't a simple fighting over trivial matters. It was very cosmological also, right? Everything was cosmological for them.
They were like,
we think about sports as we go and watch a football game or a basketball game. It's seen as recreational, as fun, you know, but they had ball games and a game called Chunky that is sacred to them, is as sacred as going to a temple and worshiping. And in this, one team represents the powers of light, the other team represents the powers of darkness. And when they play this game, whoever wins or whoever loses, for them, there are cosmological repercussions. And they also used it as like a form of divination in a way. If the powers of darkness win, what does that say about our harvest season or next year's crop? You know, So everything was wrapped up. And that was also true for raiding. When two tribes came up against each other, it was very much a question of what's tomorrow going to look like for everybody,
Right. And I just have to say that the powers of darkness still firmly reside in West Georgia, and the powers of light live in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. So I'm just saying, we still execute those rituals every single year.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah.
So they were like spiritual warriors in a sense, right?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So so the reason I said all that, when the colonists came in, they put an end to that real quick.
Yeah.
You know, I remember a quote where one native chief, he was saying, he said, we do war like you do baseball. And there's layers of meaning there because remember baseball for them, that's sacred.
Yeah.
He's saying that war is a game, but games are sacred, you know? And so the colonists pretty quick, you know, put an end to that because they said, no, you can't go raid someone else. That's unprovoked. And but really the colonists had no conceptualization about how they operated, about the cosmos they lived in was very different from the cosmos that the Europeans lived in. And you know, and a lot of the Mississippians are still around. They're just around under other tribal names that you would recognize, you know, the Cherokee, the Ojibwa, or the also known as the Chippewa, the Osage. These are the remnants of the Mississippians still here today. So they didn't just disappear, but their way of life almost totally did.
And they
should be teaching this stuff. This is fascinating.
Isn't it fascinating?
Yeah, it is. Right. I mean, Megan would be interested in all this. Her daughter. Yeah, yeah, this is really interesting.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
This has been great.
Yeah, this has been great. Our hour's up, but we could just keep talking to you.
Yeah,
hour's up already? We just
I know. It's great. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, this has been terrific. Thank you, PDM. We're glad you're safe.
Thanks for joining the Mystical Underground. Visit www.themysticalunderground.com for the latest blog post and book info. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or your favorite podcast app. Listen to the podcast at podcast.themysticalunderground.com. Follow Trish and Rob on Instagram at Trish and Rob McGregor. Follow us on Twitter at The Mystic Cast. Send email to podcast@themysticalunderground.com. And until next week, thank you for listening and stay mystical.